Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show, Science Facts and Fallacies podcast. So excited to be with you. My name is Cameron English. That's Dr. Liza Dunn, toxicologist, physician, all-around lovely person. It's great to see you, Liza. How's life?
Life's good. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Yes, yes. Apparently, green beer is just like a poor college student thing, because that's what we did back in the day. But you just informed me there's an elevated way of celebrating St. Patty's Day. And I'm not Irish, so I didn't know this. But you're like, no. That's the stop putting green food coloring in your Keystone Ice and actually, you know, you can drink
some Jameson.
There you go. Right. Right. Be responsible, everybody. Don't drive. Don't jump out of a tree. Don't have too much. There you go. Right. This is not medical advice. Anyways, I hope everyone's enjoying their St. Patty's Day. And let's talk about a little bit of science.
Sounds good.
Then you guys can go do your Jameson and Coke or whatever. whatever the sophisticated do these days. I don't know. Okay. First up, gene therapy has restored hearing for a second child. Here's why some deaf people adamantly oppose treatment. Next up, genetic embryo screening for health issues and IQ inch closer to reality. Here's a primer on what you can expect. And finally, a bill to ban cell-grown meat makes its way through the Florida legislature, and scientists and other researchers are divided on the potential consequences. Okay, another spicy week here on Facts and Fallacies, everybody. Welcome back to the party. So this first story, this is from originally the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is by a reporter named Tom Avril. And he's talking here, and I'm going to let Liza explain the science in a little more depth, but there's been this recent explosion in gene therapy research. And so there's some genetic conditions that are now treatable. And it's really fascinating stuff. There's one for some rare types of blindness, as this article is all about. We're starting to treat certain kinds of deafness in young children particularly. There's really cool cancer therapies going on. And the basis of all of them is you go in and you make tiny tweaks to a mutation somewhere in somebody's genome, or you replace a defective gene, whatever the specific may be. And as a result of this, you can effectively cure the condition. It's crazy stuff. I mean, and the science here, the different surgical procedures involved, it's revolutionary. It's really incredible. But as Avril describes in this story, there is a segment of the deaf community, I guess we could call it, that doesn't like the idea of treating deafness, especially in young children, because they can't consent to it. Because I believe these procedures are done when they're like under a year old. It's in infants. So the argument from these folks is, deafness is not a disability. It's not a disease. It is a way of life. It's an identity. And so necessarily these people develop community because they learn sign language and they learn to interact with each other. And right, they have to, it is a legitimate challenge, right? You have to make your way through the world without one of your senses. It's very difficult, you know? So you get a kind of bonding between these people. And so their pushback here is, we don't want this, right? This is not something that we want to eliminate. And there's one person quoted in the story that says, this is a form of eugenics even. You know, that's how seriously they take it. And then you have the pushback. You have parents, for example, like most children who are deaf, their parents can hear. And so obviously these people want their children's hearing restored before they go through life having to struggle that way. So that's just a rough outline. Let's talk a little bit about the science, Liza, and then maybe get into some of the ethical edges here, because there's some interesting stuff there. But tell us just how does this work at basic?
So there are hundreds of different genetic mutations that cause deafness. And so this particular genetic mutation was a gene that encodes for a protein called otoferlin that is produced in the cochlea of the ear. So you've got two kinds of deafness. You've got conductive deafness where the mechanics aren't working to transmit the signal from the actual ear, but the nerve and everything works, right? And then you've got sensory neural deafness, where the actual organs for hearing, like the cochlea, the hair cells on the that transmit signals, and then the auditory nerve, which actually takes the signal to the brain and processes it into information that you can hear, don't work. So this is a type of sensory neural deafness where you have a mutation in the OTOF gene, and it encodes for a protein, otoferlin. And what it does is that the inner ear will detect sound, but it can't transmit it through the brain to the brain from the cochlea into the nerve into the brain. So you get the sound waves in there, the sound waves get changed to electrical signals in the ear, and then they can't go further than that without this protein. And so what these doctors did was they took the gene, the normal gene, and put it into a virus that's been neutralized so it doesn't cause any kind of, it won't make you have a cold. It won't make you get sick or anything like that. And then they inserted it into the actual part of the ear, the cochlea, where this protein is missing. And then the cells in that ear are then programmed to start making this protein, and you can actually convert it into real sound now. So it's really amazing scientific technology that's going on with this particular mutation. They've got several other mutations that they're working on too, to try to fix this thing. But then the question becomes is, when is this beneficial? So I think one of the big issues around the first child that they worked on at CHOP was that he was already, I want to say 11 or 12. And one of the really interesting things about brain development and development of making sense of your senses is that often if you don't have that sense kicked in to that part of the brain that manages the sense by a certain critical window, you won't actually be able to do much with that sense. So for example, the critical window for blindness, if you don't correct blindness, let's say a child is born with blindness, but it's a correctable form of blindness. If you don't correct that blindness by 8 years old, those children often won't have developed the part of the brain that can see so well enough to be able to interpret that information going to the brain. So the theory is that the same thing may have happened with this kid. He is old enough where he has not had input to that part of his brain for a long enough time that he may not be able to interpret those sounds. So although he says that he hears, what is he hearing and what is he translating into that part of the brain? Is it going to be just a bunch of nonsensical stuff? And is that going to be overwhelming? Because there are case reports of people with congenital blindness that have had it reversed that talk about how overwhelming it was to be all of a sudden getting this information that they weren't able to process because it happened after a certain age. So that's a kind of interesting ethical question about what's this kid hearing. The other interesting ethical question about this is if you don't develop language by a certain age, right? You wind up, so this child was born in Morocco and developed his own kind of sign language, but it's not a universal sign language. So he has not been given a bunch of language skills around this. So is he the ideal patient for this procedure? Does this procedure actually really offer him a benefit? That remains to be seen. And there are some very reasonable discussions as to whether or not it will be beneficial for him. Now, for much younger children, I think that, you know, it's pretty cool and it provides them with, you know, the opportunity to not have lifelong deafness. And so I think that there are a lot of benefits that come from it. And, you know, it's one of these things that it sounds like a good idea, but it also opens up a whole bunch of questions about ethics, doing work on kids who can't consent and a whole variety of things. There's a whole can of worms that goes with that.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And in particular, there's a quote in here from a woman named Sarah Novick, who apparently is a novelist. I'm not familiar with her work, but she's somewhere in Philadelphia. And she asks this rhetorical question. She says, is it ethically sound to experiment on a child for a non-life-saving treatment from which the benefit is questionable and who cannot legally consent? And I thought, where have I heard that argument before? Gee, that sounds awfully... Familiar. Yeah, right. Right. So it's sort of amusing that we'll have these sort of discussions without acknowledging the broader context where there are truly insane things being done to kids. And yes, these sort of concerns are just kind of brushed aside. It's like, what are you, a bigot? What I mean? And
right.
So that was kind of amusing just right off the top there. But I think that what struck me here is that the objections are not coming from the patient population necessarily. They're not coming from the parents, which would be the most likely proxies for the kids.
Yeah.
It's this, they're not a lobby, strictly speaking, but it's this activist community that wants to say, we get to define what deafness is, and we get to tell you whether or not you may give this to your child, for
that's
example.
Right.
That's the impression that I'm getting from this argument, and that is really bothersome to me. As a parent, and just as a person that likes liberty and likes making choices, and I think, in particular, what concerns me is that restoring someone's natural function is not eugenics.
No.
I think that's one of the most silly misnomers I've heard in a long time. It's like, and again, to use a sexy philosophical term, the teleology of your ears is hearing. They're directed toward picking up sound so
that's
you can
right.
make your way through
the
world.
Yes.
Okay. So it's not, eradicating an identity or anything. And like one of the valid points in here is that, you know, this may or may not work in every case. And so it's probably smart to teach a kid who might have hearing loss or might never develop their hearing perfectly. Teach them sign language, teach them how to grapple with this. But nevertheless, restore their hearing if you can. I think that's a pretty reasonable balance, but I just thought that as a premise was kind of silly, that this is eliminating diversity. It's like, no, it's eliminating something that hinders people's lives. And just think about how much joy you get out of listening to music or being at a concert or, you know what I mean? And as a
hearing
lifelong musician,
your baby talk,
yes,
right?
It's incredible. You know, so the fact that kind of losing all of that is being equated with, you know, saving someone's identity, it doesn't ring true to me.
Right. Yes. I think that's exactly right. You're restoring function. And that's one of the important things about medicine is to restore function.
Right. Right. To heal people. So I guess maybe the best way, like a lot of these criticisms, it's like, okay, well, if the kid's too old, then it's not going to work very well. Okay. So then it needs to be done when they're younger. And maybe there's refinements that need to be made. But it sounds like to me like this is even better than a cochlear implant. Because one of the challenges with that, from the outside, my understanding is that sometimes, especially early on, people would get them, and then it wasn't hearing like they thought it was hearing. It was something that kind of emulated the sensation of hearing, but it wasn't great in many cases. This actually seems like, I think the guy that does the procedure at CHOP said, it's like having full hearing with like earplugs in. Something
that's exactly
like that.
Right. That's
okay.
Exactly what he said.
Okay. Awesome. Well, I mean, this is very cool. I think we'll follow this and see what happens. But
it's really exciting research. And I think it will help people's quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Read into this. It's fascinating. There's a picture on the article. It's the surgeon that does the procedure, and it's like a little tiny needle with a drip, just a drop of liquid on the tip, and like all of it, it's a little viral vector, and then the gene. It's just fascinating, you know, that
it
we
is.
Can do this. So yeah. Okay. All right. On to our next story. Very very exciting stuff. Potentially scary stuff, actually. So this is called genetic embryo screening for health issues. An IQ inch closer to reality. Here's a primer on what you can expect. This is by Dr. Barbara Billauer, one of my colleagues at the American Council on Science and Health. She is a legal scholar. She works on occupational health issues and bioethics. As I've said before, she says I'm not allowed to call her a bioethicist because she doesn't run around hospitals unplugging people's ventilators. So she does not want to be grouped in with those people. But nevertheless, she covers a lot of these issues. And here she's talking about some really fascinating slash potentially horrifying technology.
Talking about eugenics.
So in vitro fertilization is not a new thing. It's been around since the 70s. But these days, it's being paired with embryo selection, and in particular, a technology called pre-implantation genetic selection, where because of improvements in whole genome analysis, you can take an embryo and you can screen it, and you can say, this embryo has a 32% chance of developing type 2 diabetes or such and such chance of developing whatever condition. And so some parents are beginning to look at this and go, so that means I can sort of pick and choose the health outcomes of my kids. And it's also, and this is real, you can look this up. There are people, the big brains among us in academia and nonprofit groups and the World Health Organization are starting to go, gee, I wonder if we could force people to have kids with certain health outcomes or prevent certain diseases, right? So that's a long way from happening, but there are very credible people that have a lot of power who are starting to make this argument that, well, we force people to vaccinate their kids, so maybe we can just force them to have kids with certain traits. Wouldn't that just be great if we could just tinker literally with the fabric of humanity, right? So this is, and Barbara's article doesn't go that deep, but she's talking about a lot of the technical challenges that go along with this technology, with a lot of its limitations. Again, Liza can get into the details, but one of the ones that strikes me is that these tests that you do on embryos, they are associations. It's an association between a mutation and a health outcome, but it's not a causal. You can say you might get this, but you can't say you will get this and you will get it at this point in your life.
That's exactly right. So now there are certain things that you can test for that you can say that you will get this, right? So if you've got a monogenetic thing like Huntington's or something like that, then you can predict that. But this is looking at polygenic inheritance, meaning that there are a whole bunch of genes that contribute to the development of a certain kind of disease, like diabetes or cardiovascular disease. Not type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune thing, but type 2 diabetes, right? Theoretically, you could look at a bunch of genes playing into making an autoimmune reaction too. So it's maybe some kind of association there. But anyway, long and short is that they're taking a statistical model and saying that there is an association between the expression of this gene and the development of this illness, which will maybe happen to this embryo at 40 years down the road or 80 years down the road. And if we look at how people have assessed risk just in general, and the paranoia about risk just in general, and the uncertainty about risk just in general, I think making the leap to saying that we can predict cardiovascular disease and diabetes and cancer and all of this from a statistical model on an undifferentiated embryo at this point. They're just looking at trophoblastic tissue when they're doing this, which eventually becomes a placenta when the egg is fertilized and it starts dividing, it turns into a blastocyst, and part of that winds up being tropoblast, which invades the endometrium of the uterus and becomes the placenta. So they're looking at those cells and saying that they can predict all sorts of stuff. Well, they can't predict. You can't predict a whole bunch of stuff especially if there's an environmental association or an epigenetic association with the development of a disease. You're not necessarily going to be able to predict that from one cell. And just because you have a model saying that there's a probability that is not causal. And looking, you know, picking embryo, we're way too early on in this to be able to accurately predict anything along those lines.
The thing that gets me about this, and I've said this before when we've talked about some of this technology, it's you're right, it doesn't work the way that it needs to work for this to happen yet, but, and Barbara alludes to this, it's going to get better and better, and then pretty soon these sort of scientific and clinical objections are going to fade away, and then you're going to be forced to confront some of the ethical issues. And this is why I wanted to discuss the deafness story. Barbara talks about in another article she wrote, and that it's, if you just go to ACSH.org and look at her work, you can find some references to it. But she points out that, you know, if this technology really comes to fruition, if it really gets to prime time, you could get people like that segment of the deaf community we were talking about. You could get people who say, I want you to effectively breed me a child that has a high likelihood of being born deaf because that's part of my identity. Or you have people that say, I want you to give me a child who has a higher likelihood of depression because depressed people make great artists and comedians and their personalities are just so much richer, right? Obviously, that's a real problem to start to think about that. And then what happens to the kid? Let's say the kid grows up and goes, you know, I'm on antidepressants and I've had a life full of terror and disappointment because you bred me to be depressed, you know, like what sort of, you know what I mean? What sort of legal issues does that open up?
Well, we already have save your siblings.
Yes. Tell people what that is, by the way.
Your siblings are siblings that are often children who are born by IVF, in vitro fertilization, that are selected for certain traits that will save another sibling. And it's one thing if it's they're using your cord blood to help a child who's got, you know, some kind of anemia or some kind of blood dyscrasia, right? That's one thing. It's an entirely different thing if you are asking that other child to be an organ donor, right? And this is where Save Your Siblings get very, very kind of, it's a child that is not able to consent to a procedure that can effectively cause harm in order to save another child. And, you know, while I understand the angst and distress that the parents have about saving their firstborn child, the other child is also a human entity, and it is unable to consent to these procedures. And so it really raises a huge issue. And if you can breed designer babies to be organ donors for everybody, that's a really slippery slope. It goes against, you know, the most basic sort of ethical tenets behind medicine. Beneficence, non-maleficence, autonomy and justice. So I think that those are fundamental principles that they're the guiding principles behind first do no harm. And so, you know, it's one thing when it's a slippery slope. It's one thing when you're selecting for children who won't have a disease or you're trying to treat a disease, but it's an entirely different thing if you're, you know, breeding designer babies just to fit your worldview of how people should look. And that's eugenics. That's eugenics just at the molecular level.
Yeah. And before anyone jumps in, I know I can hear it already that there's the debunkers out there that go, hey, the slippery slope, that's a fallacy. If it isn't clear, we are talking about people who are making this case right now. They are making the case that this needs to happen, that it's a good thing that it happens, that in effect we need to commodify human life. It needs to be a consumer good where we turn you, and there are high profile people saying this. So the one I'm most familiar with is Jamie Metzl, really sharp guy. He's a fellow at the Atlantic Council. He's affiliated with the World Health Organization's One Shared World program. So very legitimate guy. He wrote a fascinating book called Hacking Darwin that talks about this technology. I interviewed him on the show, and I recommend the book. But he explicitly says, you know, maybe it's good that we can incentivize or maybe even mandate people reproduce this way. And he's said things like, sex will be for fun and for pair bonding. And then this technology will be for reproduction. Okay. So I just wanted to get that out of the way. You know, the slippery slope is indeed slippery. And this gets nasty really quickly. Let me give you one other example that I'm sure will, make lots of people shake in their seats a little bit. So one of the more recent theories, Kevin and I talked about this last year, I think. One of the more recent theories about why homosexuality persists in the population is because, and because typically gay people don't reproduce, obviously. So one of the reasons that trait persists through the generations is because the same genes that control your sexual proclivities or tendencies, whatever you want to call them, they control other traits. And so that's one way that homosexuality might persist. So what happens when this technology gets to prime time and you get parents that go, well, I don't want a gay kid. Yeah. Right? Wherever you come down on that issue, that's going to be bad news bears. That's going to be a really serious ethical argument. And right. I think the point I'm getting at here is that as a culture, we're so frayed and we're so in disagreement about fundamental moral questions like this, that this is going to be like setting off this is going to be a Molotov cocktail that we're just kind of like.
That's right.
There's a real problem here. And so I guess what I'm saying is we need to figure out the moral framework for this before we go any further. If we can't do that, we need to stop this. And people call me myopic and I'm a navel gazer and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, well, let's see what happens. Okay.
They're talking about using machine learning and AI to establish these relationships. Just imagine if they've got the wrong information going into that algorithm, right? Because once again, you don't know what influences some genes have on other genes. And as long as we don't know that in that kind of granularity, it becomes very difficult to do this responsibly.
Yeah. And again, it's recent history chock full of examples of people with the greatest intentions, supposedly, yes, just destroying untold amounts of innocent life.
They're talking about doing this for ADHD and autism. And I am of the persuasion that those are spectrum disorders and those are selected for. And yes, you don't want a very fundamentally autistic kid who's hurting himself, or, that's a hard, hard problem to deal with. But you also want somebody who is going to be able to, unlock some of the mysteries of science by being able to observe things that, ordinary people can't. So I think that these are spectrum disorders, and that people always classify folks that are on the extremes as the reason why you should get rid of this thing, as opposed to understanding maybe what they've contributed to society. So, this kind of goes back to the, I can understand where the deaf community is making this argument about, these things. It's a dilemma. It's a real dilemma.
Yeah. I mean, again, there's no easy answer, but it seems like maybe a baseline starting point would be, let's fix things that actually harm people or have the potential, there's one example that Barbara gives in the story, I forget the condition, but some state started mandating you had to test for this condition, because if you don't catch it and you don't adjust diet.
Yeah. PKU. Okay.
Yes.
Fetal ketonuria. So yes. And that came from screening from postnatal testing. And that's why, and kids are tested. There's their blood's tested with about 4 days after they're born to see if they have any kind of genetic mutations that diet could rectify, or if they, need, if they're hypothyroid. There are a variety of testing that they can do just to make sure kids are once their enzymatic processes have kicked in, to make sure they are screened for diseases that are manageable by diet.
Yeah, fascinating. So, I mean, that sounds to me, again, as just a non-specialist, just a guy with opinions, that seems like a good baseline is, are we making people healthier and more able to make their way through life? Maybe that's the best way. But I think what scares me about this, and this is a quote from C.S. Lewis's book, The Abolition of Man. This is from 1943, and I think he's really getting at why this is so troublesome. And he's talking about, once you have this technology ready to go, he writes, unless we have a world state, this regulation of this technology will still mean the power of one nation over others, and even within the world state or the nation, it will mean in principle the power of majorities over minorities, and in the concrete, a government over the people. And all long-term exercises of power, especially in breeding, must mean the power of earlier generations over later ones. So, like, fundamentally, this reshapes humanity in mm-hmm. in ways that you can't go back. There's no control alt delete on this. That's what I think is significant. And he wrote that, what, 80 years ago? I mean, that's right. So, big things on the horizon. It's not going to be tomorrow, but we need to start thinking about this because it's coming fast.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Finally, a little less controversial, not very much, but there are a rash of states now proposing bans on cell-grown meat or lab-grown meat or cultivated meat or basically meat that doesn't come from slaughtered animals, whatever, buzz phrase you want to use to describe that. And this is an article. I think this is from the student newspaper at the University of Florida. Mm-hmm. It's called The Alligator. story is called Florida Cell-Grown Meat Ban Leaves UF Researchers Divided. This is by Zoe Thomas. Pretty fascinating story. And in terms of balanced reporting, I want to say this is one of the better stories that I've read.
Kudos to that student reporter.
Yeah, this is very, very good in terms of presenting the issues involved and getting all the perspectives and leaving the reader to go, I don't know how I feel about this. But the gist of it is you have the established agricultural industry, or at least certain segments of the meat industry, that are getting really nervous about this lab-grown meat stuff. And one of the ways that they're trying to limit its progress is by just passing laws at the state level that say, this isn't allowed. You're not allowed to research this, or you're not allowed to research these projects for commercialization. I've seen a few others where there's just like really stringent regulations that effectively lead to a ban, is basically what happens. So it's the same sort of tactics that the organic food advocates or the non-GMO people with the labeling and so forth, same kind of tactics just applied to lab-grown meat.
Yes.
And so there's all sorts of issues we can explore in the article, but the advocates of this technology are saying, this is hindering our ability to improve the sustainability of food production, and there's problems with animal agriculture, all the topics we've discussed. But they're basically saying you're hitting us in the shins, you're stopping us from solving a problem for your own commercial interests. And then there's perspective from a couple of researchers, or at least one for sure, who works in extension at the University of Florida. I forget which campus. Yeah, but this scientist says, this technology may not be as great as it's cracked up to be. I'm opposed to this legislation, but I think this is being oversold as a solution to our problems. So there's a lot up in the air here, but that's the basis of it, is that you have certain interests within the food industry that are trying to shut this down, apparently because they see it as real competition, or they're concerned for one reason or another. But what did you take away from this?
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. What I think is also kind of interesting is listening to the lab-grown meat people express their concern about what they've actually been doing to the cattle people. So it's what comes around goes around. And I am a big believer in, let's experiment with this. This is, there's not enough protein out there. I have no problem with, going down this route and learning, doing science that helps with protein production and high quality protein production. I do have a huge problem with that, the group of those people saying that you should not eat beef, and going after people's livelihoods and saying that they've got the moral high ground, and trying to shut down the production of animal protein. So they're getting a little dose of their own medicine right now. And I think that neither side should get that dose. I think this should, while I do think that there should be regulations that revolve around people's health, making sure that this is a safe technology, I don't think that there should be regulations that are saying that you can't use this particular method for producing something. Just like I don't think we should shut down organic. I think there's nothing wrong with organic, except for it doesn't feed a whole bunch of people. So I think that these are different production methods. They're both very, very, I think the lab-grown meat's a very interesting way to produce meat. I don't think it's going to be very cost-effective because most people are, when I saw it presented in at the Consortium of Universities for Global Health, it was $18,000 to produce a pound of beef. And so I think that the cost is an issue. They've got a couple of products on the market that aren't selling so well because, once again, consumers actually have to buy into whether or not they want to buy your product. So, I think using the sort of heavy-handed legislative process to support your version of morality is not a good way to legislate. And I think that more research should be done on this in terms of, you know, the technique and whether or not it can make high quality protein. And I have no problem with researchers doing research. I do have a problem with trying to shut down other industries.
You know, I'm no lobbyist, but it occurs to me that maybe a better way to approach this would be to pass or lobby for legislation that says you're not allowed to ban animal agriculture in our state.
Yes.
You're not allowed to shut down extension.
Yes.
You're not allowed to implement these idiotic Eat Lancet dietary guidelines, which are science-free, hocus-pocus, vegetarian propaganda.
That's right.
Right. So if you take that route, it seems to me from a strategic point of view, no one can accuse you of rent-seeking or of, you know what I mean? You're going to get the standard, well, you want people to die of heart disease and saturated fat is bad, blah, blah, blah. But you're going to end run all of these issues that you're dealing with right now. Just as an aside, I think that might be a better way to approach
that's
it.
That's a really good idea.
If you want to pay me $1 million to help you write laws, right here.
Yep.
The other thing, though, and to build on what you said, though, which I think is actually really, really interesting, is that, you know, these lab-grown meat folks, they're like super smart tech bros. They're like Elon Musk, except they really like genetics and you know what I mean? Like, I think it's funny for them to sort of play the martyr card here and say, you know, you're beating us up and we can't do our work. Da, 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 da. The reason they can get away with that is, as we're sort of discussing right now, is like there are huge institutions with a lot of money and a lot of influence that are trying to eradicate animal agriculture. So I mentioned Eat Lancet. That's their whole thing. They're on a crusade to get meat increasingly out of your diet. We just saw in the European Union, in Germany, and some of these other countries, farmers clogging up the freeways because the governments are trying to force them to sell their land or restricting the amount of greenhouse emissions to the point of absurdity where they couldn't actually produce food.
That's right.
You know, so in other words, you don't have to kind of play this legislative shell game or whatever you want to call it, because there's powerful people doing it for you.
That are doing it for you. That's exactly right.
So, but I think your point is really, really important, which is that no one gets this. No one gets to play the rent-seeking game. Nobody gets to buy a monopoly in the market. Just make your product, and whichever one people prefer.
That's what they get.
Yeah. That's how an economy should function in a healthy society.
Fortunately, this bill died on March 8th. I looked it up.
Good. Yeah. Good. Personally, I'm not crazy about the lab-grown meat thing. It seems, as we've talked about before, nature gave us cows. Cows do the bioreaction that you're trying to do in a laboratory with public money. So just,
and
invest your money, right? So just stop it.
Yes.
Make the cows better.
Yes, that's exactly right. I'm with you there. But I don't have a problem with people doing research on. I think it's kind of interesting.
No, I think that's 100% correct. And competition should make this better. And there's actually a point, I forget who made it in the story, but somebody says, you know, the things that they're trying to figure out, like how to produce these proteins more efficiently and how to make sure that the end product is nutritious to the point that it's going to fulfill the needs people get from like a steak or whatever. Those same things could be applied to animal agriculture.
Yeah.
You know, so in other words, right, what makes Ford a great car? A Chevy. Right. It's this kind of constant back and forth. That's how you get
high quality.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you for joining us. Go check out all these stories. This is a really cool, I mean, we try to pick cool stories every week, but I think these ones in particular
are particularly cool. Yeah.
Yes. And they've got shelf life and there's some significant things. So yeah, go check these out. In the meantime, follow us on X. It's at Dr. Liza MD, at Cam J English, and at Genetic Literacy. Follow us, interact with us, try to get back to you if you write us with questions. Sorry, I'm sometimes slow on that because things get busy, but we love to interact. So follow us. And go check out geneticliteracyproject.org because they put the show on for us. They get it out to all the platforms, and we're very grateful for that. So check it out. And with that, we will see you next time.
See you later.